So it's recording. So I am begin with all participants introducing themselves. My name is Anita Schmaltz and I am 38 years old. Today is February 9th, 2018, and I'm speaking with John Zimmerman, who is a longtime coworker of mine, and we are recording this interview in Dayton, Ohio. So, tell me about some of the early HIV/AIDS work that you did.
So, I am 69 years old, and I found myself in the late 80s learning about HIV/AIDS, and of course, by the end of the 80s and by 1990, there were AIDS service organizations that were getting started up, and we volunteered to be in buddy programs, and that's where you were assigned to a particular person with HIV and or AIDS to help them, both just with friendship or maybe taking people to go to the grocery, helping people do all kinds of different things or just sit around and talk. So buddy could be, you know, many things. And one of the things that, looking back on it, I realized we had no idea what we were getting into. And that's okay, because if you do, sometimes you might not do things. And all of us took on a lot more work, you know. So I was living in Dayton. Mm-hmm. I had friends 45 miles away in Preble County, which was to the west, and I had a buddy out there. And then I also had a buddy in Middletown, which is like 25 miles south. And I, you know, put more miles and gas in my car than I ever thought I would. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up doing things that we never expected, you know, that we would. So that was all happening, you know, through the late 80s and on up through the 90s. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of experiences, and out of those early happenings came some institutions. So, for example, there was no services in the Richmond, Indiana area, and the people from Ohio, from Preble County, where my family was from, and from Wayne County, which is the county that butts up to Preble County from Indiana, got together and in somebody's living room started an AIDS task force. Hmm. And lo and behold, several years later, it becomes a part of the hospital there.
Wow.
And so that, you know, we learned how to write grants, we learned how to do all kinds of things that I was in the food and beverage business, you know, that we would have never learned how to do had there not been, you know, this AIDS pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, I didn't realize that it started in kind of that task force in someone's living room. That was, yeah. So what were some of the challenges that you, what were some of the challenges with it?
Well, one of the things that we soon found out was that there was just lots and lots of discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that there was discrimination in public accommodations, there was discrimination in employment, but one of the worst was housing discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what brought me to fair housing, because as we help people, all of a sudden we found families being thrown out of their apartments. And we had one family, a mom and a dad and two kids, and all four had HIV. Mom and dad had been IV drug users, and then they got HIV, they got pregnant, they had children. Mm-hmm. And when their family found out, they had rented from a relative, and the relative had given them a lot of furniture and stuff like that, and they moved all the furniture into the yard, set it on fire, and locked them out of the house.
Wow.
And we just couldn't believe it. And so that there were lots of other things, you know, that, that happened. I remember there was a guy that died, and a whole bunch of us were going to go to his funeral. And we got to the funeral, and everybody was leaving. And we found out that the brother of the man who had died had purposely lied to all of the gay people to make sure that they did not come to the funeral.
Oh,
and
wow.
Told us that it was, you know, later than what had been announced.
Wow.
I remember walking into the parking lot as everybody was leaving, and the guy's mother's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I wasn't the one who did this," you know, and trying to apologize to me. We were just stunned that
yeah.
people would go to those lengths.
Yeah.
You know, we had friends who were partners, and they'd been together for maybe 20, 25 years, and one of them was living in a home that this partner had bought and paid for, and so during his funeral, he came home, and the house had just been cleared out.
Wow.
You know, and then and he had been locked out. And so they even took his stuff as well as the partner's stuff, you know. So
wow.
these were some family members. So, you know, there was lots of those types of challenges.
Yeah. So what were ways in which the gay community specifically faced those challenges head on? So thinking about... for the individual who lost everything?
Well, we took our cues from other professionals.
Okay.
So we had some really good fortune to meet some people. So
mm-hmm.
we met a guy, for example, in Dayton, Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and his name was Jim McCarthy, and he had become experienced. He worked with in a law firm,
mm-hmm.
and he was not an attorney, but he was a staff person, and he
mm-hmm.
knew the workings of government and stuff like that. And so that there were situations like at Social Security offices trying to get people benefits
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And so he taught us that what you do is you go with your client up to the Social Security office,
okay.
and you announce to everybody that your client has HIV/AIDS, and boom, the whole place would clear out. And the staff would have no clients except our client to attend to. And so
that is one.
It was like, you know, so we were just learning
yeah, yeah.
little things to
so
do
fun.
To, you know, that would say, okay, let's get someone's attention. And then we ended up through some of those actions making some friends in the Social Security office. And in the Richmond area, one woman asked if she could join our board of directors and she could give people guidance.
Oh, wow,
so
wonderful.
What turned out to be, starting out to be some in-your-face stuff, that once, you know, you met and you had this human element, and
sure.
then the Department of Health, all of the Department of Health really got out there and educated people, like the people at the Social Security office, that, no, you're not going to get AIDS
okay.
from somebody walking in the room or,
yeah.
you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
So we just, you know, had some direct action we had to do, and then we'd get good results, you know, over
cool.
time.
Yeah. Okay.
So those were, you know, some of the things that we learned.
Yeah. Awesome. So any most memorable experiences that you can think of that you want to share?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to share is that one of the challenges we ran into were we met people of every type.
Mm-hmm.
And we met some people with HIV who had mental health challenges and other types of physical challenges. And so that some people with mental health disabilities and stuff were really, really at a disadvantage. So we met a couple named Richard and Pete, and they were just like polar opposites, and maybe that's why they were together as a couple. Pete was highly educated. He was a musician. He was well-spoken. He could just do everything you could imagine, but he was 100% blind.
Mm.
And his partner, Richard, I am not, you know, a doctor or anything, but all we know is that Pete let us know that his mental health diagnosis was that he had more than one personality.
Okay.
And so when you talked to Richard, you had to figure out who you were talking to. And there was like good Richard, and there was bad Richard, and there was crazy Richard. And so that in dealing with these guys, I was assigned to be a buddy to Richard, who had HIV. Pete did not.
Okay.
But they had some needs that they needed some help with, and they applied for a buddy. And because I lived in Dayton, but I helped in Richmond, Eaton was like on the way. And so we saw, they lived closer to there. They first started getting some services there. But we ran into terrible things. Richard was coming home one day from a store, and he had all these bags of groceries, and these kids chased him and beat him up. So, you know, we walk in and he's got bruises all over, and we don't know, and getting him to tell us what happened was very difficult.
Sure.
And so calling the police, and because he would tell us one thing, and then there would be this, what appeared to be another person coming out of him telling a different story, you know. And so the police were all befuddled.
Sure.
I mean, so it was really difficult. So they said, we need to get somewhere else, because Richard was getting really, really bad.
Yeah.
And so we helped them move from there to Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Okay.
And there was, one of the reasons that they went to live there was that if he ever had to go to a nursing home, that was where a nursing home was that would accept people with HIV. And you know, Yellow Springs is much different than Eaton, Ohio. It's kind of a more liberal place.
Yeah.
And Pete, who, even though he was blind, he had this great memory. He could get on the bus and he could go anywhere. And if somebody helped him once, he would have it memorized. He'd get off of a bus, and if he was going to the store, he would know exactly where to turn right or left and how many steps it was to the store and how many steps up in the store. I mean, he, you know, was just very adept at getting around. So he could walk to the nursing home every day and see Richard.
Nice. Okay.
So we facilitated that move and borrowed trucks and all this stuff and moved them up there, you know, and got them, you know, ensconced in Yellow Springs.
Oh, cool.
And so the so that was the start. You know, he wasn't there long that he went into the nursing home, and he was really physically, he had opportunistic infections and things that were going to lead to his death. And so there was no money. That was the other thing, was that Pete got some disability, and Richard, having gone into the nursing home, if he got any benefits, it went all to the nursing home. So he was on Medicaid and stuff like that. So, but there was no money. Zero money. And Pete, you know, in the early 90s, got the lowest amount of money that anybody could get.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it was $500 or $600 a month. I mean, and he had to pay rent, and he didn't have, at first, a subsidy. He later on got one, but at first he didn't. So, so it was very, very difficult. So Richard died, and Pete had made arrangements with the Unitarians to have him buried. And so when he died, we were all prepared for it. And so he was really into baseball, and he had a baseball outfit. So he died. We were there when he died. We washed his body. The nurses helped us. We put him in his baseball uniform. The doctor came in and did the death certificate, pronounced him dead. And then we got him to the crematorium within 2 hours of the time he died. And that was the rule. I don't know what the rules are today, but back then, that was the rule. If you got somebody there, you did not have to have them embalmed.
Okay.
And you had
within
to get
that window.
Yeah, you had to be in that window. And so this all happened like at 1 a.m.
Oh my
you
goodness.
Know, and so we had this big station wagon, and we had a cardboard box coffin.
Oh my.
And we washed his body, put him in the baseball uniform, put him in the coffin, put it, you know, wheeled it out on a gurney and into the station wagon and off to the crematory, you know.
Wow.
And it cost $200.
Wow.
And the group of us that helped, we just all chipped in the money.
Yeah.
And then later on at a gay church, we had a memorial for Richard. And so that was really nice. But that was just, you know, we had never expected to do things like that.
Sure.
You know, and there was other things. I mean, we learned how to do things like handle a feeding tube. It, you know, because people would be at home needing a feeding tube because they have wasting syndrome, and so that was a really heady time that we were just like our whole lives were just completely involved around it.
Sure.
And so then after the cocktails, you know, and people start getting better and stuff, the you know, we then started moving away from, you know, that stuff. And we did a lot of quilts for the Names Project, and that's a whole nother story. And I can end by telling you a great story. Was a friend of mine who is still alive, and he lives in Columbus, but when the cocktails first came out, he had already gone to hospice. And it, normally in hospice, you get rid of all the medications. Mm. And his doctor said, oh, you know, we know that Ed's going to die, and but let's go ahead and try to give him these cocktails just to see what might happen. And Ed had totally made his peace with dying, okay? And okay. We went up to see him, and he was getting worse and worse and worse. And then all of a sudden, he stopped getting worse. And then, like, a month went by, and he was, like, walking around hospice. I mean, he was laid out, had lost 80 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, I mean, this is a big man who had gotten just tiny. And he was so mad that he was going to live. That was, you know, and we all had this big laugh. He was like, ah, I was ready for it. You know, now I don't know how to live. You know?
Oh, God.
I have to get ready to live again.
Yeah, yeah, that's a stuff. Huge mindset change.
And yeah. So we are really thankful. The whole thing that changed was the cocktails.
Yeah, cool.
Drug cocktails.
That's a good story to end on. To that note there.
So. Yeah, it is. So.
Well, cool. Well, thank you. I'm glad that we got to do the interview.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Are you sure you're finished with the recording? Yes.